Hello, my name is Raj Mehta, and welcome back to Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. How are you today, Richard?
Well, thank you. Slight trepidation about invading the territory of palliative care today in relation to evidence-based medicine. Trepidation because it's quite an emotive topic, which has affected me throughout my working life, really from the time I was a medical student, and even beyond, in the sense that my most recent memories of palliative care are in relation to my wife, who died under palliative care 2.5 years ago. And I've been fairly deeply involved with palliative care for most of that period. Perhaps I won't sort of list my so-called credentials in detail at this point, but perhaps they'll arise as we go along.
Thank you for that introduction. I think it's important because palliative care and end of life is a really important topic and closely related to a lot of EBM. But I think it's important for listeners to know that this talk isn't just one based on us thinking through literature and experience with patients, but also born of our own personal life. And I think that adds a lot more subtlety and nuance. And I want to thank you, Richard, for your willingness to talk about this because I know your personal experiences has been difficult and challenging for you at times.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, the people who I have seen through to death, one to one, are my parents, who died from heart failure and ovarian cancer, respectively, and then my wife, who died from adenocarcinoma of lung. And comparing these experiences has actually been a learning experience, obviously, for me, but has lessons which I find hard to draw out sometimes, but I think they should be drawn out. And I think we should have a debate about the extent to which palliative care, which is a personal one-to-one relationship and a very close following of the patient through to the end, can be linked up with evidence-based medicine as we've been discussing it. And obviously, the method of least squares and all that stuff hardly applies to this. But nonetheless, it impinges on it in some ways. So this will be very different from last week's session. But on the other hand, I think I'm hoping it will be equally informative. Though I must say, I don't think my presentation skills quite match up to yours in the field of statistics, particularly. So, do you want me to start historically as
I
we've
would love that. I was just thinking, palliative care in some ways is a more recent field. And I certainly think there's a transition that happened in medicine when we recognize as a larger community, as a field, that medical gains and outcomes was not just based on survival, but that quality of life mattered. But then institutionally adopting that and changing the way we thought about and practice it was very important. And I'd be curious to hear your experience of that change in eras.
I mean, a lot of it is from my own working lifetime, but it does predate that. And we're talking about quality of death in the context of the patient, but we are talking quality of life in the context of the people who watch the person dying, which is a very, very formative experience, and no one can be unchanged by it. So the whole family group or the group around the dying person is part of what palliative care should address. Now, from my own personal point of view, I came across terminal care as a student. Now, that was a very new concept. That was 1973. I think the hospice in Oxford had just been built. And it was supposed to be an academic unit too, but there was no such thing as academic terminal care at that point. And so we were shown around by a GP who was telling us about his personal philosophy and so on. That changed gradually as I became a GP in the Oxfordshire area. There was now a senior academic, Robert Twycross, in charge of this hospice. He was a fanatic for scientific palliative care, quite rightly so. He's still alive. He really taught the concept of extreme attention to the patient and to any form of distress that the patient was undergoing. And his ways of addressing that were largely pharmacological, but the whole ethos of the hospice under him, we're talking about 1980 now, was one of deep attention and support. And this spread out from that hospice, and he was very influential to me. I started in general practice in 1979. Within 2 years, I went down and learnt terminal care, as it was still called, under his auspices. And in fact, it was therapeutically extremely simple. The drugs were the ancient drug opium in the form of morphine and dimorphine, and the ancient drug senna, which is basically there to alleviate the constipating effects of the morphine. And there was an antiemetic, which was either chlorpromazine, which also acted as a sedative, or metoclopramide, which in those days was still being used a lot. And that was about it. There was diazepam. Lorazepam hadn't appeared yet, and there were a number of other tranquilizers. So this was a tiny formulary, but it was very well deployed in these patients who were lucky enough to come under his care. And I could see that these were all drugs that I had in my bag and could deploy in my own practice night and day. And it was considered the done thing in those days to be on call 24 hours for your dying patients, which I think was an excellent principle, quite hard to carry out. So that was that. And that was, as I say, called terminal care. And then as the 80s proceeded, that morphed into what was called palliative care. And I'll break off there for any observations you have, Raj.
It's really great to hear a little bit of that history, and interesting how some things remain unchanged, because even today, a large part of the pharmacological management of palliative care is based on managing pain, managing constipation, managing symptoms with nausea, tranquilizers, as you call them, newer drugs, perhaps better side effect profiles, but those pharmacological principles are still there.
Yes. And in fact, they date back to 1898, we believe. There was a surgeon, actually, in the Cancer Hospital of London, rather, who decided that there were these two new drugs around. One was called cocaine and the other was called heroin or dimorphine. And he thought, my patients are all in agony and I want to alleviate them. So why not give them a cocktail of heroin and cocaine? And this was called the Brompton cocktail, because the hospital was in the Brompton area of London. And eventually it had some chloroform water added to it, and I forget what else, gin, that's right. So it was alcohol combined with these things, and patients felt wonderful on it for their last few days of life, which was a good thing. And the Brompton cocktail was still being used in Oxford in 1970, in fact. And all the subsequent developments grew from that cluster of drugs given in liquid form to people who were at the very end. And then in the 1980s, it became clear that not all cancer patients by any means were near the very end. In fact, some of them would go on to live a normal lifespan, but they were in pain, either due to the effects of treatment or, the usual things, metastases and so forth, but they may have been blasted away by radiotherapy and They might be left with a lot of problems, which people who had looked after the dying were well placed to address. And that was not just in hospices, but also in the community. And we as GPs, some of us, were very eager to learn these tricks and to deploy them and not refer our patients, because one of the big things in palliative care is continuity and trust and the reassurance that comes from knowing your doctor cares about you and will see you through. So all these factors I've now mentioned have little to do with EBM in its usual statistical form. So perhaps we ought to go back to that territory at some stage.
Yes. So one of the core aspects of EBM, which sometimes we skip over in our eagerness or my eagerness to discuss research and methods and data, is that patients' preferences are a core part of determining how we apply evidence. And then a good part of that is also our clinical judgment of how we navigate patients through this process. And I think sometimes there's a kind of an unspoken or assumed sense of what the patient's preferences are. And sometimes we have to elicit and ask them what's going on. And I think with palliative care, it seems to me that part of this revolution over the decades was understanding that you can't just implicitly assume with these patients who maybe have pain and terminal conditions, but are living a long life, what their goals are. And it's important to have a method and a process that incorporates what their goals are with how we approach it. And then having appropriate pharmacological and non-pharmacological support measures with some evidence to support it to kind of offer to those individuals.
Well, you've left me with little to say. That is a wonderful summary of the situation. And it is indeed how most palliative care researchers approach the subject. So just to summarize where we've got to, we've got the evidence that underlies palliative care is largely evidence of a mechanistic kind, which we tend to decry sometimes, because the whole point of testing treatments is to see whether the mechanisms really do work as we think. But we're dealing with very traditional drugs here, which work for the vast majority of people, but they don't work for some. And that's where palliative care starts to get a little bit complex and diverge from the typical group trial basis of evidence-based medicine. So how would you characterize the kind of research that you need to determine individual effects?
Yes. So this is a challenge. A lot of evidence-based medicine is hard outcomes, like looking at survival or medically observable events. And then we're looking at groups, and we're looking at groups and seeing if a drug A can help improve survival, less mortality. And then we have a group estimate for how that works. And in theory, one of the ideal methods is that if you want to look at how an individual is responding instead of a group effect, sometimes people have described this as personalized medicine, you either need to look at subgroups with very large data to kind of support that analysis, or you need something like a crossover trial where you have groups that get it, groups that don't, and then you have a washout period, then you switch who gets it, who doesn't, and then you try and look at that crossover data to determine, are there individual effects with certain characteristics of individuals or subtypes that can kind of help? And that's hard. It's hard to do those types of trials. It's hard because different patient characteristics are not well defined. It's hard because different disease characteristics are sometimes not well defined in boundaries. So it's tricky to do that. And then a lot of times it really comes to our clinical judgment, understanding of different physiology, different states, really the context behind the research to try and interpret when and when it might not work.
Yeah. That's beautifully put again, but it does raise fundamental issues which make it impossible, in fact, to do this humanely in most circumstances. And those factors are the inevitable instability of the condition that may not always apply, but it certainly tends to apply as people near death. And the other thing is the fact that you've only got one opportunity to get it right. And so You can't have washout periods, because that would mean all the symptoms coming back with full force and horror to the patient. So for those reasons, palliative care as an individual experience between a doctor and a patient can't involve a lot of randomized research. You have to get around it somehow or other in order to stay true to the purpose of palliative care, which is to keep the patient comfortable and supported at all times. So that I think means that we're probably not going to be talking about conventional EBM very much at all in this talk. I think that raises a philosophical problem, which I haven't seen very well explored, I have to say. And I'd quite like to write an essay one day on palliative care and the limits of evidence-based medicine, because I think these limits apply outside palliative care too, to all symptomatic treatments in distressed patients. To go back to our central argument, if there is such a thing in this chat, I would say that the main drive of EBM is to purify a question and answer it in a way that applies to most people. And in fact, in palliative care, we're not against complicating the issue, and we're not against ignoring what happens in groups in favor of what establishes trust and symptom relief for the patient. Now, that's pretty way out stuff, and a lot of palliative care can be way out, and I used to think that was terrible, you know. Aromatherapy, oh, for goodness sake, you know, acupuncture, reflexology, what we call bullshit in normal life. But you will find, as you approach dying, that you will cling to any kind of treatment that works for you and gives you comfort. And that's why I don't think we should try to be big white coat scientists marching in and saying, take that off, get rid of that aromatherapist, you should say. Okay, if that's what floats your boat, fine. We should be open to all sorts of other peripheral interventions. But I think that our pharmacological brains should remain pin sharp through all this, in fact. And that may seem a bit paradoxical, but I do believe that. So what do you think of that statement, Raj? Do you think that's right?
I think there's a lot of value there. And I would clarify a little bit, because there are areas of palliative care where there is strong evidence. And some of it's because interventions have just such large and obvious benefit effect size. Doing things like, you know, opioids to manage cancer, pain, the basics you mentioned before, helping treat nausea, constipation, the core medical management, I think has a lot of good data to support it. But as you're putting out, there's a lot, perhaps I like your word, of peripheral interventions or other ways to help patients cope with what they're doing, whether it's pain or other emotions or challenges that they face near the end of life. And it's very hard for us to study all these various interventions. It's very hard for me to know how much acupuncture might benefit someone at the end of life, how to even measure those kinds of outcomes. And so then, you know, in these areas where either it's we don't have data, or I'm not even sure how I would even begin evaluating some of these things, I think we have to be open to a little bit of the absence of evidence, and we have to have a different approach to it. We can't just have a pure RCT or nothing approach to interpreting what might be helpful to a patient, whether it's a placebo effect or real. And that allows, I think, a little bit more nuance and openness to things that we might not do appropriately for more rigorous outcomes, you know, in EBM.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It brings us on to, well, two or three different issues. One of them is how we evaluate complex interventions, which tend to be favoured by the palliative care community, these studies, because they can be carried out in a cluster randomised way. But they are more to do with service delivery than the actual hands-on management of individual patients. And they have their value, of course.
Yes.
For instance, what's the best place of death? Now, you raised the point about outcomes. What is a good death? No death is good for those watching it. We hope that some deaths are good for the person experiencing them, but we have no way of asking them afterwards. So we assume that certain principles carried through are always going to be valid, and one of them is not to burden the patient with a huge number of unnecessary interventions, many of which are distressing to look at, never mind to undergo. And so many studies have been done about trying to stop people dying in ICU who are obviously going to die. Why should they die in a place like that? Why shouldn't they die in a hospice or their own home, or, to be very radical, out in the woods, you know, wherever they want to, provided that they're being well looked after. And I think quite a lot of US palliative care research has focused on those sorts of factors. These count as complex interventions, of course, very complex interventions. And the problem with these, as with all complex interventions in EBM, is A, are they properly characterized? B, are they replicable? And C, do they apply across the board or only in the context that's been studied? So there you've got big philosophical issues or methodological issues that apply across EBM. And I don't think palliative care has particularly sorted that out, but it's trying.
And I'm glad those sorts of questions and trials are being done, because we've discussed this before, but sometimes EBM can get very focused on what providers or industry is interested in, and patient interests matter too. And if patients want to know about their options, about the different places they can die and their locations, then we should be doing studies on delivery of access, of like where they can go and whether these things can be provided and whether it meets their goals of what they want. They're complex, and how to interpret them and how to generalize them is hard. But these are the topics worth addressing. So I'm glad that they're being done.
Yeah, the only book that I've written on palliative care, or about anything, in fact, is heart failure in palliative care. And there you've got a tipping point issue as well. You know, at what point do you give up doing invasive interventions on patients? Where do you say enough is enough? I don't think anyone's answered that. And the other thing is, you know, how do you provide a good death in heart failure? Those are issues that at least people are addressing now. In the 1990s, they weren't willing to look that way at all, and now increasingly they are. But it's taken an awfully long time since my father died in my own care in his home in Sheffield back in 1992. So, I'm pleased that I've been part of an incremental movement to widen the scale of palliative care, because it still is very cancer dominated. We've covered a fair bit of ground. What else would you like us to talk about, Raj?
I think this idea of this tipping point of when we switch from thinking about, I may have a terminal condition, but there may be options for cure. Should I focus on survival? And then when do you switch to, you know, actually let's focus on quality of life? Because patients ultimately have to make that choice. But then when do we as providers, how do we engage them? And when is it appropriate for us to nudge them? And when is it appropriate for us to be respectful, even if we think there may be some futility in their wishes and their goals?
That's a wonderful, again, that's the third time I've used wonderful about what you've summarized, because I think it is absolutely bang on. And this how shared understanding of treatment of medicine, which was the title of my brief chair at the University of Birmingham, how do we make for a shared understanding of dying? Do we want people to understand what dying can involve? I hope not, because dying from, say, pulmonary edema, drowning, is not something you want to go into with patients, but you want them to avoid it very much. And so you, as a doctor, may think, no, please let them have a sudden death from an arrhythmia. Don't make them have to go into hospital desperately short of breath, terrified, with distraught relatives, time and again, until the final time when they do actually die. You know, those are the options in heart failure. These are horrific questions which one can't be too unkindly open about, perhaps, with patients. But there has been a great deal of research that supports the idea that you mentioned, which is, how, to what extent does the patient want the goal of survival? To what extent do they want their treatment to be determined by themselves or by those in charge of them? And at what point do they think intervention should stop? And if you've covered those bases, then you've covered an awful lot, and you may not need to go into these other difficult questions. Though many have, I mean, in terms of ICD implantation and so on, because you have to discuss to some extent. And actually, consent for an ICD should, and a cardioverter defibrillator implanted, usually together with a resynchronization device, which has been common practice now for 15 to 20 years. And I don't know what goes on in real life about shared decision making for that, but I know that if I were a person with heart failure, I'd want the resynchronizer because it would improve my symptoms, but I wouldn't want the ICD because it might shock me repeatedly at the end of life, which is not the way I want to go. A burst of electric shocks and combined with terminal pulmonary edema. But anyway, I've said enough on that now. Let's move on to the final phase, because we've covered about half an hour, and it's time to draw things together.
So I want to take a moment, and this is a little bit of a personal question, Richard, but just to ask you about your own experiences with your wife's end-of-life care and how that shaped some of your perspectives on this topic.
Thank you very much for giving me that opportunity. The thing that struck me was the variation in the level of care and kindness that she received. And this was during COVID. So it was very often impossible to visit her and very hard to get through to the people who were supposed to be managing her. And she took a very decidedly pro-life view of her goal. She could see that her care was chaotic and unsatisfactory. That was hospital care. And she was not going to sign a do not resuscitate order until somebody had actually done the proper medical workup on her, which they never did. And then she came under hospice care. A wonderful consultant who's very well known, Rachel Clark. I was very lucky to get the best person in the UK looking after my wife as she was really entering the dying phase. And at that point, knowing that a proper diagnosis had been made and that all care was being given to her at the hospice, and she was sitting out in the garden having tea and doing exactly what she wanted. At that point, she didn't want resuscitating, but she wanted to come home. And they organized everything perfectly for that. And then during the very last hours, of course, things did get horrible. But by then she was unconscious, and we had a wonderful time together. So my takeaway from that is that there needs to be one good person in charge. It doesn't matter who it is. It can be a nurse, it can be a doctor, preferably a doctor with good experience. Someone must carry the can, though. You can't talk about team care without having a leader. And you must have support in place all round the clock, because the worst things often happen at night. And it's no good having a good daytime service alone. You do need the good time daytime service. You need to make it as good as possible. I covered a hospice out of hours for 10 years, hardly ever got called because all the right drugs were already there and the nurses knew what to do when people were dying. That didn't apply in general practice, but I tried to make it apply through the local general practice out of hours schemes. And again, I needed to be the person in charge when my own wife was dying, which was wrong. People should not have to be in charge when their loved ones are dying. That should be taken from them. So someone should always be available and kind and quick. Okay. This is nothing to do with evidence-based medicine. The evidence comes from me. Okay. And on that note, I think I shall end.
Richard, thank you so much for sharing your story and talking to us about it. I know it's something that still gets you emotional 2.5 years later, and I can't imagine that experience, but I'm glad that you felt positively about the experiences that your wife had near the end, and your willingness to share and talk about that, because I do think that these experiences and these cases are helpful to all of us, because we learn from other providers. We learn from doctors before us, from patients before us, that tell us of their experiences, and all the data in the world, it doesn't coalesce as well as understanding people's experiences in that context and really painting that picture and understanding what's happening and understanding the importance of why we have to get these things right, why we have to do it. I can read as many papers as I want about the importance of team-based and leadership and having full 24-hour support. But, you know, until you're there in that shoes and you understand those experiences, it doesn't always fit together. And so I think that's hugely important. And I think one of my things that I've learned from you talking about this is that as good as EBM is through all these things, you know, clinical judgment does matter. And that judgment comes from understanding the experiences of our patients, of ourselves, reflecting on that and learning those lessons, listening to other people's stories and knowing what that means.
Thank you, Raj. That was quite difficult at the end, but I think it was worth doing, and I hope it's of value to people who are listening to us. Thanks.
Thank you, Richard.